This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, low-wage workers get ready to converge on Richmond, Virginia, for a national convention to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. A Black political prisoner wins a long court fight against the state of Pennsylvania, and Black people in the South American nation of Colombia try to forge a sustainable peace agreement with guerrillas and the government. But first, the two major political parties have chosen their presidential contenders. We spoke with veteran activist and author Kevin Alexander Gray in Columbia, South Carolina. With Hillary Clinton, the corporate war hawk, heading up the Democrats, and Donald Trump, the white nationalist in charge of the Republican Party, what's a progressive voter to do? Kevin Alexander Gray in Columbia, South Carolina. Low-wage workers from around the country will gather in Richmond, Virginia on August 12th and 13th for a national convention to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Terrence Wise, a Burger King worker from Kansas City, tells us why the Fight for 15 has chosen to meet in the former capital of the Confederacy. That was Terrence Wise of Fight for 15. Since his capture and incarceration in 1972, political prisoner Russell Maroon Schoetz has spent most of his years in solitary confinement in Pennsylvania prisons. The former Black Panther and Black Liberation Army member recently won a landmark court settlement that bars the state of Pennsylvania from putting him back in isolation again, and awards Schoetz a monetary settlement. Schoetz's family members have been key activists in his defense team. We spoke with daughter Teresa Schoetz. Teresa Schoetz, daughter of political prisoner Russell Maroon Schoetz. Peace talks continue between the government of Colombia in South America and FARC guerrillas who've been fighting the regime for two generations. Black Colombians and indigenous people have borne the brunt of displacement for the long years of civil war, but have largely been left out of the peace talks that have been going on in Havana, Cuba. Charo Mina Rojas is with the National Afro-Colombian Peace Council and the Ethnic Commission that has been bargaining for Black and Native Colombian people's rights.
You know, there's always options. I voted for Jill Stein. The last election, I'll probably vote for this election. There are a lot of options. There's the socialist option. There's the libertarian option. There's the green option. You don't have to vote for the, in this case with Clinton and Trump, it wouldn't even be the lesser of two evils. It'd be two evil people. And so there are choices that people can make. And it's just good now that there are people running with the various third parties to give Americans a little bit of education on the third-party system, on proportional representation, on cumulative voting, just on parliamentary government, just all kinds of things that we could be educating people on in this election as opposed to watching them make one or the other bad choice.
And, of course, people shouldn't stop what they usually do in terms of organizing just because there's an election going on.
Absolutely. You know, one of the good things about Barack Obama leaving office for Black people in particular is that perhaps they'll pick up the signs, pick up their feet, and follow behind the youth, especially the older people, follow behind the youth that are out here in the streets challenging the system. Perhaps some of the older people that have held their fire since we've had this Black president for fear of embarrassing him, maybe now they'll go back to doing what they were doing before Barack Obama was getting elected, and that was at least making some type of demand on the system.
Of course, Barack Obama's supporters back in 2008, and they persisted in 2012, insisted that there was a movement behind Barack Obama. But that's not the kind of movement that we saw appear in the second part of his term.
Well, some of us knew that that was just about the empire having a friendly face to run the empire. And this idea that Barack Obama and neoliberal politics, Wall Street politics, corporate politics, assassination president, charter school president, if anybody ever thought that there was a movement in the Democratic Party, they were just fooling themselves.
The impetus for Hillary Clinton's candidacy seems to be fear. Fear that she hopes will create a big tent in the Democratic Party.
Well, Doug Henwood called it right. He said the Democrats talk about the Republicans running on fear, and then you have the Democrats running on fear of Donald Trump. And that's what American mainstream politics has been based on. It's been based on fear, and some politician is going to save you. Some politician is going to offer you security from your fear, be it fear of Muslims, be it fear of Latinos, be it fear of black people, be it fear of gay people, be it fear of anything other than something that's familiar to them. And so the nature of American politics is about fear. And that fear usually translates into empire and support of white supremacy worldwide.
Does Hillary Clinton in any way inherit the kind of special historical status that Barack Obama had in the black community?
In all honesty, probably yes. I mean, she's running to be the first woman president of the United States. And a lot of blacks that participate in the Democratic Party are taking the position that it's her turn. Now, it's her turn at running the empire. You can't really see ultimately what they're going to get out of it, although, you know, Hillary Clinton surrounds herself with a lot of people who feed at that trough, but the Democratic Party corporate trough, and that the idea of elite capitalism or bossism. But historically, if she won, she'd be the first female president, and a lot of people will get excited about that. But when you go back and look at the policies that she's pursued, the policies that her husband pursued, the policies that Barack Obama pursued, you're still going to have a healthy dose of empire and neoliberalism.
Trump says that he is the law and order candidate of the Law and Order Party. When the Republicans first started calling themselves that more than two generations ago, there was a much smaller law and order apparatus. Now there are more than 2 million people in prison, the biggest prison system in the world, and it was a bipartisan affair.
Well, of course, we all have been talking about Clinton and the 92-93 crime bill, and the fact that when Clinton left office, there were more blacks in jail under Clinton than Ronald Reagan. And of course, Bill Clinton famously said, buy one, get one free. So we can assume the same is with Hillary, buy one, get one free. And of course, Bill Clinton ran to be tough on crime, so as to say he's tough on niggers. And there's nothing different about what Trump is saying. He's just basically saying he's going to be extra tough on niggers. And this idea that young black kids would challenge their mistreatment by the police apparatus to declare them thugs, to declare them potential terrorists, to declare them enemies of the state. I'm afraid that if Donald Trump were to be elected, a lot of white people who feel ultra-empowered now because Trump is running for president and wanting to take back the country for them, they'll really feel empowered and off the chain, as some of the young folks say, if Trump is elected. And I would think that we would have to organize against that. We'd have to organize against that real hard, because he would unleash a different kind of vicious, murderous force, not just police officers, but white folk who feel empowered and who feel that police ought to control black people by any means necessary.
Sounds like you're talking about those brown shirts, but of course we experienced them with the good old boys not that long ago.
Well, we got police officers with badges who are no better than the Klan. We've got police officers who have been in the military who think that everybody is an enemy, especially black people. And of course, America is built on the idea that black people represent an internal threat to this nation. Part of it is because of their inherent feelings of revenge. And if the shoe was on the other foot, if they had been enslaved, they would respond in a very, very violent way in their minds. They actually believe that black folk haven't, some of them believe that black folk haven't responded violently enough to the oppression that they face. So black people in America want to live in peace. Black people in America want to be able to educate their children, want to be able to have a home, want to be able to have a job at a decent wage. Black people do not want to take from white people, but what they want is fairness, and what they want is to be recognized as part of the fabric of this country that built this country, the part of this country whose descendants are the foundation of modern capitalism, not some kind of taker, not somebody that relies on some white person for a job or for their existence. I honestly believe that. Now, you know, part of their reasoning for supporting Democrats and supporting Hillary so hard, there are a lot of people that want to be accepted by white people. And that's part of the idea of being involved in mainstream politics. But for the most part, black people are not the enemy of the United States. They're not waging a war on white people. They're not waging a war on police officers. And this idea that you have people running, a person running like Donald Trump, that thinks that he can unleash the military industrial complex known as the police department on the black community, that does give you reason to think that we're in, if he were elected, we would be in for real dark days.
Well, it was worth noting that when Hillary Clinton spoke to the NAACP's annual conference, she led off that speech with an admonition to respect police, and she said that an attack on police officers is an attack on law and order itself and all of us. She put that right up front.
Well, you know what? This idea that black people are waging a war against police officers is just racist. In the same way that, I mean, I'm not a big fan of D.L. Hughley, but the idea that Dylann Roof can go into a church and shoot up a whole lot of black people, and black people don't declare that all white people are Dylann Roof, and we don't engage in a national conversation about how bad or how scary or how criminal white people are. When the young man goes into Sandy Hook and kills up a whole lot of kids, we don't talk about whiteness. We don't engage in a racial dialogue with the problems with white folk at the core of that discussion. I mean, all of it is just implicitly racist.
Young folks are defying those powerful voices that demanded that they stand down in the wake of the killings of those cops in Baton Rouge and Dallas. What's this say about our incipient movement?
I think that there's a movement growing. I still have my criticisms of the movement, that it has to find its context in history and a latch onto it, that they can't just think that the last 30, 40, 50 years that their parents and grandparents did nothing. A lot of their grandparents and parents got us to where we are today as far as an understanding of the police state and the militarization of the police departments. You still have to not only do the event and block traffic and go after the police when necessary, you still have to do that basic grassroots organizing in the community, and you have to reach out to people within the community and try to get them mobilized, especially the ones that go to the meet. You know, my biggest critique of the movement is, yes, we need to be in the streets, but yes, you still have to go to the meetings where they make the decisions, and you still have to put some pressure on the political process. You still have to hold your local political leaders accountable, and you have to have a concrete list of demands and follow up on those demands. It's all right to say we ought to have citizens review boards, but you have to work to make that happen. And so that's a part of what the young folk are doing that the older generation can help them with, because a lot of what they're proposing are things we've been proposing most of our careers, and it's time to make that happen. We need to stay on this whole idea of legalization, decriminalization, to take the teeth out of racial profiling. It ought not just be white folk leading a marijuana legalization effort. It ought to be ending racial profiling, which means ending the war on drugs.
Well, if incarceration rates were scaled back to 1972, I've calculated that 6 out of every 7 prison inmates would have to be let go, and 1972 wasn't that good a year.
Sure, we ought to be having amnesty for non-violent drug offenders. That's what we ought to be calling for. We ought to be calling for releasing those prisoners who are in jail at a minimum on marijuana charges. We need to go back and look at some of these laws that have a lot of these young folk all tied up in conspiracy charges or with conspiracy charges. we've got to go back and look at a lot of the laws that put these young people in jail and dismantle those laws. And that takes more than just organizing in the streets. That takes organizing in the communities and figuring out a way on the state and local level to make that happen too.
Yeah, because we're going to have some political prisoners in large numbers, it appears, rather soon, and we've still got political prisoners from 40 years ago and more.
The young folk are getting it. I just reposted a young friend of mine's post on social media about raising a bail fund for the people in Charleston, and those things matter. Having lawyers already set to defend you when you're going out there to protest, those kinds of things matter. You have to have all engines firing when you're talking about taking on the system. And you have to have a plan to get your comrades out of jail. And you have to have a plan to get those people who are your comrades that don't know they're your comrades out of jail and help them have some kind of consciousness about this movement that we're trying to build.
It's convention season in this country, so we're having hours after the Republicans and the Democrats meet. But it's going to be low-wage workers from a broad range of industry, truck drivers, fast food workers, gas station workers, airport workers, retail workers, low-wage workers in general. And we've picked Richmond, Virginia. We know that this country was built on slave labor. And we're going back to, like you said, the heart of the Confederacy, Richmond, Virginia. We'll be rallying there and marching and doing some demonstrations as well in Richmond to highlight that these low wages and the racial inequality in this country is not only hurting black and brown, but it's hurting the working poor white people as well. And until we can build a coalition, build our movement, and bring all of the workers together, the 64 million workers, that's a powerful block of workers, until we bring us all together to demand economic justice and racial equality, we won't get anywhere until we can get this accomplished. And so Richmond, Virginia is not by accident, by history. And we know that in the heart of the Confederacy is where we need to take the fight.
And in fact, the old states of the Confederacy are the heart of the right-to-work region in the United States. And that's no coincidence either, is it?
Oh, no, it's not. That whole right to work, it sounds good, but we know it's not. We know it's hurting working families like mine, and it's really nothing right about it at all.
It's been said that the U.S. labor movement made a crucial mistake after World War II in failing to commit the kinds of resources that were necessary to organizing in the South, and that failure was because the Southern workforce was so heavily black.
And that's one thing that we're learning today, that history has no students, but it teaches. And that's something we learned from the past labor history of the failures of the labor movement. And we know that you can't have economic justice without racial justice as well. So you got to fight the fight on both grounds. You got to take them both on head on. And we learned from the past that, especially in the South, that's where the labor movement went wrong. But we're learning and we're going to correct that. We're going to win the battle on both fronts, and we're going to take it to the heart of the South, the Midwest, and wherever in this country poverty and racial inequality exists.
And of course, Richmond is the capital of the old Confederacy, but these days, Richmond's local government is black-dominated. What's the reaction, or what reaction do you expect from the local black powers that be to this convention of low-paid workers?
Well, we know that poverty has no color. It has no color. It affects white, black, brown, and white. And the elected leaders, we really as low-wage workers don't care the color of our elected leaders. We know they'll only be what we make of them. So the people that we put in office can only make moves that the people, the workers, are behind them on. And we will only elect and we will only stand with legislators and elected leaders that are working for working families. The majority of Americans do what every day? Wake up and go to work. So why shouldn't our elected leaders be passing laws and writing legislation that helps us and not corporations?
In Birmingham, another heavily black city, a living wage or a wage increase was passed but reversed by the Alabama legislature. Do you see that as a trend, and how do you organize against that?
And we had similar events take place here in Kansas City. This past summer, we've been organizing here in Kansas City and putting pressure on our elected leaders, the mayor to get the minimum raise here in Kansas City, and we got that passed through our city council 12-1. Wasn't even a close vote. That's like a blowout to win it here in our city, only to have legislators in Jefferson City, the capital, take it away. So we had that similar thing happen here in Kansas City that happened in Birmingham, so I personally know what that feels like. And how we organize against that is workers in the Fight for 15, low-wage workers in this country, have been organizing for 4 years. And it's always been a fight against these companies, these corporations we work for. And we've seen over the years that elected leaders have taken notice of the fight and the perils of low-wage workers, and they've decided to do whatever they can and ramp up their efforts to raise the wages for workers, and that can be through legislation. And we saw that happening not only in Birmingham and Kansas City, but all across the country. And that's something that we stand for and will stand with in the Fight for 15, and we'll have to continue to organize. We know that the city council in Birmingham and Kansas City didn't just wake up one morning and say, okay, we're going to raise the wages. We're going to jack up the minimum wage. They did that in response to the pressure and the power that workers have built. And what it tells me, the incidents in Birmingham and Kansas City, is that workers just have not built enough power yet to force these legislators and elected leaders to stand by what they say and to raise the minimum wage. But we will continue to organize and build our power until we win, not only $15 in those cities, but all across the country.
And of course, you're not fighting just for $15, but the effective right to form a union and to bargain. You're a worker yourself, and you've met workers from across the country in your capacity. If a vote were held today, what proportion of, let's say, McDonald's workers do you think would vote in favor of a union, if they could?
I know when we look back at history and when we think of unions, the most prominent and well-known in this country, the auto workers. And we know what they fought for and how they fought to win their union and better pay. And this is a new time. This is a new time because this is not one McDonald's, one shop like my McDonald's. But we have McDonald's, who is the largest employer in the world, employing workers all over the globe. An opportunity to organize with workers here in this country and organize with workers in Brazil. I've been Dublin, Ireland, and some European countries. And I've met McDonald's workers there as well. And so a global company has to be organized and struck back on a global level. And I know workers, not only in our country, but all over the globe, about fed up. And it's about time for McDonald's and other large corporations to pay workers a living wage. So I would say we've seen the polls. We see how the conscience of America has changed towards a living wage and racial inequality. And I also know from the streets, and from workers I've had the opportunity to meet around the globe, that they're ready to go. They're ready for $15 an hour in a union. Now, I know that the majority of us, I can say that with full confidence, are ready for $15 an hour in a union. I'm pretty sure we would win.
And do you see any difference in willingness to join a union among workers in the United States, low-wage workers, based on region, north, west, east, and south, or on race and ethnicity, Hispanic, white, and black?
I do see an increase in the wanting to, and it's come about because of knowledge. Workers are understanding what the new definition of union is. When workers, low-wage workers like myself, hear union, we know that's paid time off. That's an opportunity to go see a dentist. We know that that's benefits and vacations have never existed in our working lives. So we've been able to break down the barriers of what a union really means and know that it's good for us. It's going to bring about a change for our families, and we have that knowledge and understanding of how a union is not only going to help us and workers in general, but help lift the whole country and economy as well.
I'm elated. I'm not so much elated in reference to the monetary part of it, but just the acknowledgement that someone was abused for so long in solitary confinement. I'm elated because it opens the door now for other prisoners here in Pennsylvania who are still in solitary confinement. And Maroon, his thing is, I wanted my day in court. Because initially, we were scheduled for a court hearing July the 11th, 2016. But the settlement came. They mediated, and the result was a settlement where he wouldn't be placed in solitary confinement anymore, because they could come up with anything and place him back in. The unfortunate part is, yes, he's out of solitary confinement, but he's been housed at FCI Greaterford, and he's in a new area in which he's housed with a lot of mentally ill patients because of the lawsuit that the ACLU brought against Pennsylvania prisons in reference to housing the mentally ill in solitary confinement. So Daddy said in the beginning it felt like he was still in solitary confinement because these prisoners would see him come from the commissary, and he would be the only one on the unit in which he couldn't go to the commissary. And once they learned his name, Maroon, 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 was all he heard. So he came up with a plan. And what he did was, since no one was looking out for them, he purchased coffee and cigarettes for the prisoners on his unit, the mentally ill prisoners, and that settled them down. And so what they did was put Maroon with prisoners that he's unable to educate, he's unable to really have any meaningful dialogue with. He knows that this could happen again because the Department of Pennsylvania Corrections could come up with something like gang unit, or if you have tattoos, or try to open back those doors of solitary confinement unit. We never seen this monetary thing coming. But with the attorneys, with Hal Engle, with Reed and Smith signing on pro bono, joining the Abolitionist Law Center with Brett Grody, once those two merged together, there was no stopping them. They had to acknowledge Maroon, and now they're going to be forced to acknowledge others in solitary confinement.
Yes, they cited in the settlement international prohibitions against cruel and unusual punishment. It's also in the U.S. Constitution, but they didn't recognize that solitary confinement as such is cruel and unusual in the United States.
You know, the United States don't want to acknowledge it. So what we did was my family, my siblings and I, Russell Schultz III, Sharon Schultz, and myself, we pushed forward. We pushed forward. I took off. I quit my job 9 years ago. I had to battle the medical first because I thought about it. I said, one day we're going to win. We're going to win this thing with the supporters backing us. We're going to win. But I got to keep him alive, healthy, maintain the health. And I fought everything. He had the prostate cancer. He bounced back from that, the cataracts. You know, most of the illness that surface once you of age. Maroon is in his 70s. And then, of course, he followed through with maintaining, making sure he didn't eat all the improper foods, that processed stuff that they serve in the prison. So once we kind of got the medical thing going, there are still some issues, and this is why we have to get him out. The time is now. He's of age. What more can you get out of a 40-something year sentence? And he's in his 70s. Because recently, Maroon collapsed and hit his head in the cell, and then he collapsed on the stairwell about a month ago. The prison did not tell us. He was in a hospital for 5 days. It wasn't until an inmate told us he could have died. And when you have stuff on the table like a lawsuit against a big corporation like this prison thing, Maroon could have been taken out of here, and we want to know nothing. So we have to get him out of there, and we're going to keep fighting. The children, we know we got the supporters to back us up, because this is a win. I don't care how big it is. We don't give a damn about the money. We don't care how small some of our wins are. We got to acknowledge even the small wins. This money thing, Maroon doesn't have a clue about money, so it means nothing to him.
Yes, this is certainly a victory for Maroon, but how does it affect the other inmates, the thousands, of course, in Pennsylvania's prisons and elsewhere?
Well, you know, this prison bubble is going to burst. There's so many people in the uproar. We have the Supreme Court has acknowledged that juvenile lifers should not be sentenced to life sentences. Pennsylvania has the most juvenile lifers in the country. Yet, Pennsylvania judicial system, nor do our district attorney, Seth Williams, want to acknowledge what the Supreme Court has said. They're slow in releasing these juveniles. Although they're saying it's taking some time because they're putting procedures in place in reference to training these guys. Because, you know, of course, most of these state-run prisons have just gotten rid of educational services and stuff like that and released these grown men. Some juvenile lifers have been in prison some 38 years. We have a prisoner, Tempest Songster, who was sentenced like at 14, and he's 38 years old now. So you got to put something in place, and we're hoping that's the holdup. What does it mean for other prisoners? Setaway, Joseph Bowen, prisoners of my dad's era, political prisoners, Mamia Abdul-Jamal, they should be released, and we're hoping this sets a precedent for our prisoners in Pennsylvania.
And yet we don't see much agitation and have not historically seen much agitation from the black political leadership regarding political prisoners or black prisoners or prisoners in general.
Well, I'm going to tell you something. In my 8-9 years of fighting for my dad, once I quit my job, I was able to confront the governor, my state reps. And you know, I told the state rep, I have supporters. He said, but do you have 10,000? I said, that can happen. He said, well, until you have 10,000, then I may take a look at the solitary confinement day. Our black leaders in Pennsylvania, our state representatives are nothing to me. They're useless. I mean, I don't know who's feeding them, but whatever they're eating, they're asleep. They're living American a dream and they can't wake up. They're asleep.
One out of every 8 prisoners on the planet is an African American, and yet that's not a priority among black elected officials?
Not a priority when black males are being gunned down with police. So why would it be a priority with a black man in prison where there's financial gain? No, there's no priority. But what we need, the same way my siblings and I fought for Maroon out there on the front line. Maroon, you know, I told Maroon, the way we fought for him, other family members got to stand up. And when I look at it, I don't blame them. Some of them I do, some I don't. Because I'm out there on the front line and I meet family members that just don't think they can do anything. They think, oh, I can't fight. You mean to tell me I can go to my state representative? I can complain. I can not vote for them. I can go up against this system. And some of them just are so swamped with trying to live, trying to survive financially. They don't even have time to fight for a loved one behind bars, let alone visit that loved one behind bars because they don't have the money. So we're being beat down on all levels. Now, we got 2 million plus people in prison. My dad started the Human Rights Coalition group, Philly, and a human rights setup group in Pittsburgh. He said, if y'all get at least one family member of prisoners, we can beat this thing. We've been trying for years. You get the family member, they may hang in there and they may not. And they may just be swamped with issues that just are too overwhelming for them to take on the prison system.
And how is Maroon's morale holding up?
He's upbeat. You know, my son is 26 years old. My son visited my daddy touching that glass with his little baby hand as an infant. And he didn't get to hug Maroon until 2 years ago. How is Maroon? He's better than ever now. He's thinking on the next level. This money means nothing to him, so we haven't seen a smile from him. Well, behind the glass visiting him in solitary confinement, he never smiled. We could see the tone in his voice was gone. The leader that I had always looked up to and what pushed me to to stop my job and go up toe-to-toe against our legislators was no longer there. I had to keep myself up because I no longer had my leader. And then I got mad at him. And I said, you know, you put me in this position. We got to work together. I said, had you not put me in this position as a child, I wouldn't be having a fight for you. He said, wait a minute, hold up. Why wouldn't I fight against this system? Yeah, I'm in jail. I couldn't raise you, but I couldn't leave this rotten system for you. And look what's going on. I fought on the front lines for you and everybody else, and this rotten system is still surviving.
So how can folks join the fight, not just to free Maroon, but the fight that he's engaged in for human rights?
First, well, I was just at a discussion for Professor Griff in New York. Some of the black media came out because he's been linked in some kind of photo with the shooter of the Dallas police. And someone stood up and said, we got to stop giving these people our money. Stop spending with people that don't care about you. And then someone stood up against that and said, that's not going to matter. Whether we spend our money, change our banks, it's not going to matter. We first got to educate people that this system is rotten because you still have people that believe in this system. I didn't tell you this. I come up against family members. Not only are they not educated about the prison system, they believe in it. Oh, yeah, such and such should have been locked up. Oh, yeah, my son, I'm not going to help him. He should be locked up. Maybe they'll teach him a lesson. I said, wait a minute. You believe this system is going to teach him a lesson? Oh, they'll teach him one, and it's one you won't understand once he's released. So it's going to take education. It's going to stay, people standing on the front lines like these young groups, Black Lives Matter. I believe also it's going to take not spending money with this rotten system. And then this system, it's going to go deeper than this. But this system has got to go. It's not for us. It's never been for us. And if we continue on this route, our baby's coming behind me. My daddy didn't want this for my generation. Look at the damn generation coming behind us. Not only are they just out of here totally, I can't stand by and let this happen in reference to what's coming behind me, the generation coming behind me. So people can visit RussellMaroonShows.wordpress.com or Google RussellMaroonShows.com. We're strategizing with Maroon now. And what's the next step? A reporter called this morning and asked me, what are you going to do with the money? I said, well, first of all, it's not my money and it's not in my hands. Maroon, he thought about how the Rosenberg Fund for Children helped us, his family, his children, to visit him when we couldn't financially make it to the prison where my mother wouldn't take us to the prison to visit our daddy. The Rosenberg Fund for Children, they made a way for us. So Maroon is looking into making a way for family members, for children, to see their loved ones behind bars. A political prisoner has been freed, has been taken out of solitary and freed from being placed in solitary ever again. That's in the suit. Because these jokers could come up with something whereas he goes back in solitary confinement. We have always known, and it was told to us several times, that he's a leader. We can't let him out. And let me just give you this story. People know my daddy liberated himself twice. If you don't know that, Maroon freed himself twice, living on a lamb and one of his escapes for 28 days. And he was captured. But Maroon was in population after those escapes because some people say, oh, before we won this settlement, oh, they're going to keep him in solitary. I said, not as long as I'm fighting for him. No, they're not. But Maroon actually was placed in solitary confinement because he attended an all-white prison-approved lifers group. Maroon walked in a room. He shouldn't have been in there, but the guards allowed him to stay in there. He was in population at this time. Maroon got up and spoke and told them how we're all in this together. It's the same issue that's going on. If you're poor, you're black, you're brown, you're white, you can be in this joint right here. By the end of that evening, Maroon became the first black president of an all-white lifer prison-approved group. The warden got word of it the next day and said, take the vote back. I will not have this nigga as president of this group. I put this group in place and I'll take it down. The prisoners went on a hunger strike. They wanted Maroon as their president. Then they tried to file suit against the Department of Corrections. This was at SCI Pittsburgh. Within the next week, Maroon was transferred. He was in solitary ever since. And see, people don't know that story. They look at Maroon as this cop killer, which we know now, 11 years ago, it was proven that he wasn't the trigger man who killed this officer. We know it's not because of the escape. We know it's because he was looked at as an educator and a leader, and it's all in the legal documents that we got because of this court case. We know he went into solitary confinement for almost 30 years after becoming the first black president of this all-white license group.
We, as the Ethnic Commission, demanded a while ago that the two parts of the table, the negotiations in Havana, sit with us and discuss how we will make sure that the rights and interests of Afro-descendant and indigenous peoples will be respected. We have the opportunity to meet with the two parts, with FARC and the government, and came to some understanding of the need of include that perspective on the agreement. I think we gained two things. One was a public event that finally the government and FARC agreed to have with these peoples, the Afro-descendant indigenous peoples, where they recognized government and FARC that effectively the agreements reached so far have no ethnic perspective, have no perspective that directly and explicitly make effectively respect of the rights of Afro-descendant people and indigenous people. Therefore, they agree to meet with us separately. So when we agree with both of them, we get them to accept that in the agreements and the body of the document of the agreements will be a chapter that specify the guarantees, the safeguards, and the monitoring mechanisms for the implementation of the agreements to ensure that the rights, the interests, and the priorities of Afro-descendant and indigenous peoples will be met. So we gained, I think, that these two things, the recognition, the public recognition, that effectively they should have included directly the presence, the voice, the participation of indigenous and Afro-descendants, and that they agree that in the body of the agreements that will be passed by the Congress later, there will be a specific safeguards and guarantees and mechanisms of monitoring and evaluation and follow-up of the implementation of the agreements. These two things are something very important to us and things that we think that will help to ensure that the rights of people, the safety of people, the territorial rights are protected. Now, we don't necessarily, knowing how the government has evaded always the responsibilities, we don't necessarily think that this is the complete and completely ensure that we still are protected. We still have a lot of work to do and pressure to make right now before the agreements are signed and during the implementations to ensure that people is not re-victimized and the rights, our rights are not continually violated by these two forces, these two parts.
Afro-Colombians are most concerned about humanitarian issues such as the militarization of the places that you live in, that is, the presence of armed forces and of landmines in the area. Have you seen any signs that there is a demilitarization going on?
No. In fact, the militarization of the territories can increase, particularly during the times, the 180 days that has been agreed for the as a period of demobilization, or the period where FARC is going to give up arms. So we expect even more militarization during this period, and that is a great concern for us, because this period of, we call demobilization, that is going to happen immediately after the agreements are signed. It's a period that where the government is going to identify some zones for these groups to be concentrated, concentration zones where FARC will be located. And periodically, you know, it's like, you know, like everybody is going to give up their arms immediately. This is going to be a process. It's going to be periodically by groups. But during that period, these people is going to be in these particular zones, and these areas are going to be militarized, although not immediately in the areas and the zones, because that's an agreement that there cannot be guns nearby these zones. It's an agreement that cannot be guns and then people armed in the communities and nearby the communities. I can remember right now it's like 10 kilometers in the area. However, there are paths, there are corridors, you know, paths where people are going to be crossing by. There is still the need to make sure that these areas that the government is going to identify where FARC is going to be concentrated are no areas that impact the normal life of the communities, that don't impact the transit, normal transit of the communities to do their normal activities like hunting and fishing and agriculture, etc.
The FARC are supposed to give up their weapons. So when you speak of militarization, you are talking about the state and its positioning of its forces near these new zones that the FARC will be resettled in.
We are talking about the state forces that are going to set an area of follow-up and protection for both sides, protection particularly, supposedly protection also for FARC. But also are going to be areas where FARC is going to be concentrated during the process of giving up their weapons. And that means that there will be people that still will have weapons because they are using the process of giving up them. So it's no areas where you give up your weapon and then go to that area. Are areas where they are going to be concentrated and the process will be going on. So we have a concern that this will be like an over-militarization and tremendous distress for the communities nearby or in the middle of that process.
You're also concerned about extractive industries, and by that you mean things like mines and oil and gas drilling. Is there any sign there that there will be a cessation of ongoing extraction in areas of Afro-Colombian settlement?
No, unfortunately not. This is one of the things that we don't have any certainty at all that this is going to be controlled and halt. But the agreements, there is the set of agreements that are on writing, and you can see now are becoming little by little public. But we don't know what FARC and state government have agreed underneath. There are some conversations that they have had, certain things that they, for instance, in order to be able to sit down, finally, there were conversations and agreements that are not writing, at least not for the public, that we don't know. And we feel that some of those agreements that are not writing, that they did previously, have to do with the possibility for FARC to continue it related to mining activities, or perhaps developing mining activities as a way for them to ensure the reintegration and the reorganization of their civil lives. You see, when the government decides not to touch at all in the negotiations, the economic system, we are severely concerned. We are really deeply concerned, because the economic system, one of the main policies of this government has been the mining policies. And if the economic system is not social, only that's not a matter of discussion and a matter of agreements, a matter of analysis, then we don't think that this issue has been discussed in our benefit and will be discussed in our benefit and will have any elements of safeguard in our benefit. We are trying to prevent certain impacts on that matter by specifying safeguards and guarantees in this document that we are elaborating, and it will be part of the final document of the agreement.
And what you most desire to safeguard is the life and limb of people in the Afro-Colombian communities and the leaders of those communities from death squads.
Precisely, yes. So one of the guarantees that we need from FARC particularly is that they will commit to, for those, you see, not all the elements of FARC are in agreement with the demobilization. They are not, all of them are in agreement with this process. So there are, and they have recognized us, this to us, there are elements of FARC that won't demobilize. In fact, reorganize. And right now, there are certain groups, some of those, that still are targeting some of our leaders, community leaders, and community councils. So we need to make sure with them that they will commit to take care of that and take control of that situation and ensure that our leaders and communities wouldn't be targeted pre the agreements, because they cannot commit after the agreements because they are, they become a civil force, not a armed force. But on the other side, we need to ensure that the government will take care of that and will take the specific measures that are needed to ensure that the leaders and communities are not targeted, continue to be targeted. And this is one of the things that we continue struggling, working on in the conversations with the government, because this is one of those elements in, of the situation that still are very difficult to resolve.
So you are saying that some factions of FARC have not given up the fight. We know that right-wing death squads have preyed upon indigenous and Afro-Colombian leaders and communities, but has FARC been a particular danger historically to Afro-Colombians?
Unfortunately, FARC become a confrontational part in our struggle in some regions in Colombia, particularly in the south, because at some point FARC entered in contradictions between the interest of black people and the overall interest that they pretend to defend, and particularly because we defend the right to territories where they see to have control. And that become a source of conflict between black communities and FARC. And this is something that we put on the table the day that we met with them. And they recognize that there are some conflicts, but they also ensure us that they are committed to resolve those conflicts and evaluate their situation in the world.
So you're worried about those elements of FARC that are not party to the agreements, that don't want to engage in the agreements, and you're worried about the state, which has not lived up to previous accords with Afro-Colombians and indigenous people.
Right, and a state that is still support for these paramilitary forces that they deny that exist and deny that are on their side. So we have three forces still that we have to be concerned about it. These elements that we want to mobilize, and that perhaps some of them will be still in conflict with our interests and rights as black people. And particularly those forces that are lined up with the state, and the state, of course, we still in war. Internal armed conflict was happening with FARC and ELN, for instance. We have still paramilitaries on territories. We have still a state that doesn't fully recognize our rights. And so we're still in a struggle. We're still under attack. We're still target. And so it is important for us that people understand that there is no post-conflict. We are talking about post-agreements because this is one step toward peace in Colombia, but only one step toward peace in Colombia. You know, peace has to be built up with all the elements of the society, and we are part of those elements that are significantly ignored in the process. It is important that people understand that as we price how much has been gained right now, we have to say that there is still much to do, especially because there are other armed forces that the government has to sit down and discuss and agree with to fully build a durable and sustainable peace.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.